right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. I'm Chris Solomon, joined today by European Tour member, United States citizen, Peter Uihlein. Peter, you are back in the U.S. right now. You were down in Australia playing the World 6 last week. We're recording this now on Thursday. How long does it take you to get over jet lag on a trip like that?
Well, thanks first and foremost. Thanks for having me on. You know, I've been a long-time listener, so I'm excited to do this. But, the way I schedule is never easy coming back and forth from the States. So I got in from Australia. We got out early after missing the Saturday cut. Got home Sunday, and I'm back out. I'm leaving again Sunday. So. To South Africa, so it takes typically, if I try to do it like right, like it probably takes 1 to 2 days. But this week I've just given up hope. I mean, you come from where I was in Dubai, Malaysia, Australia, and then I'm here, and then I'm going to Africa, then India. So I mean, this week's just kind of a wash week for me. I'm going to bed at like 6 o'clock. My girlfriend's loving it.
So what are you doing? I guess maybe that answers the question. What are you doing back in the States this week?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have family here now, and you know, I like coming home when I can. My friends, obviously it's Honda week, so I can see some of my friends that are in town. Obviously, you know, I have my girlfriend's here, and we have two dogs, so I want to get home to see those and see them and hang out with them. So but from a logistics standpoint, you know, if you're in Australia, you're not really thinking, hey, let's go to America, then go to Africa. It's not exactly on the way. To be fair, Australia is not really close to anything, so that's never easy.
That's what I was gonna say. Is you didn't make the cut to the Saturday cut. Was the trip to Australia worth it for this new formatted event?
Yeah, it is for me, because I love that golf course. I like Karrinyup. I think it's one of my favorites we play all year. So it's funny. I like almost try and base my schedule like around that event. So for me to go down there, I'd never really find it too. I never feel like it's like pulling teeth to get down there. I like playing that place. It's a cool week. It's a good course. I wish I got to watch. I mean, like I said, I was flying home, so I didn't get to see Sunday, but. I saw that Rummy one, and Rummy, I think he had like a 5 or 6 shot lead or something stupid. So I mean, they, you know, it worked out. You know, he should have won. You know, and it worked out that way. I don't know how it looked on TV or how you know, guys, if it was exciting to watch or what. I was trying to scroll online when I landed. I couldn't quite figure it out online on the app. It seemed, I guess, guys kept playing. Like, you had guys playing for like the 5th spot and the 6th spot. I found that to be a little strange, but. The energy there seemed to be pretty cool. Like, it seemed like everybody there was like pretty excited for it. So that was at least cool to see.
So do you live full time? I guess full time is probably not the right way to say it, but you are a resident of Florida, right? That's where you call home.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm down in Jupiter with just about every other golfer.
Do you have a place in Europe at all? I know it's kind of, that may be kind of a silly question, because I've touched on this in the past, that the European Tour is really just European in name. Like, do you have a place over there at all, or any other locations?
No, I come and go. I travel back and forth. I rack up the air miles. I come and go. And the way the schedule is kind of set up, this one, the start of the year is always a little bit funny, but you can basically do it. You know, if you want to go play the Desert Swing, you can go play 3 weeks in the desert, then come home, and then go play a couple in South Africa and come home. So I always base my schedule based on kind of where I like playing. So it's a little bit more of a sacrifice kind of going and skipping some events and going to, you know, Australia or whatnot. But, you know, I have no base. So they've added, I mean, I'm probably the only guy who gets really excited about this, and I talk about it a lot, but they've added a Fort Lauderdale Dubai flight. So for me, that's like heaven. You know, I can just drive right to Fort Lauderdale, fly to Dubai. And it's like, oh yeah, 13-hour flight. That's fine. Like I'm totally cool with that.
Yeah. So how long does a flight have to be before you dread it? Or at this point, are you like, can you handle any flight time?
Yeah, I like flying. I think I enjoy it. I like shutting the phone off and watching movies and shows and stuff like that. I don't mind it at all. Yeah, I have no issues with that.
So it's a topic I'm sure you've covered many, many times, but for anyone that's listening that may not be as familiar with it, can you explain your reasoning for choosing to play European tours a full time? I know not a lot of Americans do that, and you've been out there for several years now, and you seem to be really enjoying it. So in your own words, yeah, what is kind of your thought process and rationale behind that?
Well, I think it was mostly when I was chatting to my dad. I was still at Oklahoma State. I was about a junior, and I was still in Stillwater. And if anybody's ever been to Stillwater, you're in like a little bit of a bubble. You don't really, you know what's going on in the real world. So I'd only ever been to, like, I played the Eisenhower in Argentina, and I played the Open in at St. George's. So that was the only time I'd ever ventured out really America, really even. I barely went out west, so I never really traveled. So for me, like, I'd always grown up liking, like, Ernie Els was always one of my favorite players, and Adam Scott. So it's like, you know, I look at those guys. They all started on the European tour, basically, you know. And so I guess that was kind of my mindset, you know, going out. It's like, you know, there's really no, I guess, different, you know, just because I'm American doesn't mean I have to stay in America. And so, like, I kind of wanted to just travel and see the world, and, you know, I've been able to do that. I've been to some crazy places and seen some things. So for me, it's been just an unbelievable experience. And you know, obviously the main goal to come back home for sure, but as of now, I'm really, really enjoying my time out there. And yeah, I'm having a good time, and I definitely recommend it really for anybody who wants to kind of travel, play golf, for, you know, and be able to play golf. And it's not the worst gig in the world, for sure.
Do you have an example of somewhere you were, somewhere you've been, where there's like a local custom or part of a culture like really surprised you, or you did something that was like really taboo that you had no idea was against the rules of any kind?
Well, my first ever professional golf event was in Ahmedabad, India. And so my parents basically, when I turned pro, I got an invite on the Challenge Tour, and they basically threw me on a plane and just said, hey, good luck. So I rocked up to India, and if anybody's ever been to India, they kind of know where I'm getting at with that. Might be it's just the most crazy, unreal country I think I've ever seen in my life. It's just so up down, you know. It's like the rich are just so rich, and the lower class are just so low. It's unreal. And so when I got off this plane, and, you know, you just, the sights that you see in the just everything you see. And then I remember going to we were probably about 2 hours out from the golf course, and I didn't realize at the time, like, cows are sacred there. Like, you can't touch a cow. Like, if you touch a cow, you're going to prison. So, like, they had this cow that was just crossing the street, and there was a huge pileup, huge backup, and accidents everywhere. And, like, when this cow was just crossing the street and was just chilling, just minding its own business, and the backup was just forever. I mean, it felt like it took like 6 hours to get to the course, because you just couldn't move. You couldn't, you know, these cows, you can't touch them. Like, they are sacred animals. So whenever you're in India, don't ever order steak, because they obviously don't know how to cook it. But I think that was kind of like, I mean, that was such an eye opener coming from Stillwater, Oklahoma to Ahmedabad, India. And it's like, wow, this is great. Long way from home.
The culture shock of culture shock places, I think, might be India. That's what I think people maybe don't have a full appreciation for. Like, when you guys travel, when you go somewhere, I think people kind of picture everything as private jets, and you land and you, you know, you get helicoptered to the first tee. But no, you see some things along the way. I had Chris Wood on last week, who's talking about, you know, taking 10-hour flights, then landing, then 2-hour trains to get to wherever you need to go. The places aren't necessarily right near the airport. And you do, I mean, I guess that's a question. Do you feel like you get a good sense of a country and what it's like in the time you get to spend there? Or once you've landed in a place, do you feel like it's all business?
Yeah, it depends. It depends where you go. I think there's some places where, you know, we call it quote unquote kind of like a prison week. So you don't really venture out. It's kind of the same thing, kind of Groundhog Day every day. But there are other places where, you know, you go, like, you stay in the cities and you get to see exactly what that country kind of has to offer. Like, you know, like Hong Kong, we'll go stay in the city, or Prague, we're staying in the city. You know, Munich, staying in the city. So, you know, there's some places that you go where you get to actually experience what the country and the culture is all about. And I think that'd be one thing. If I was running the tour, that's like one thing I would, there's a few things I'd try to change, but that would be one thing. It's like, hey, you know, really show everybody what these countries have to offer, you know. And I think that would just make it a little bit more kind of more exciting and more enticing for players to show up, and instead of going and, you know, playing, you know, 2.5 hours outside Shanghai, you know. It's like, at least go play somewhere that's close to Shanghai so you can stay in the city and see it and check it out. But, you know, if you're staying so far away from doing something, you know, it makes it a little bit longer of a week and makes it a little bit tougher.
In Prague, have you ever been to the bar called U Fleku?
I've not, actually.
Okay, all right. That's a must do. That's a must do the next time you're in the city. That's like one of my top European recommendations, and anybody listening to that in Prague, it's fantastic. But all right, you brought up the topic about a lot of things you'd change about the European tour. There is a lot of shift currently ongoing. I feel like Keith Pelley seems to be the initiator of a lot of format changes. You just played an event that's a brand new format. What do you think about the changes that are being made? Do you think it's kind of a proper shift towards the way golf will be like in the future? And what else would you change about it if you were in charge?
Yeah, I think I give all the credit in the world to Pelley. I think he's trying, which is what you need to do. You know, he's not I feel like he's at least saying and trying to do the right things to make it unique. Because at the end of the day, you're not going to compete with the PGA Tour. I mean, you can't. I mean, I've heard they've added like a $12 million event in Korea or something. So you can't compete with them from a money standpoint, but you can do something unique that would engage or entice players to play. And I think, you know, he's trying. You know, he obviously tried the Super 6 down in Perth, and I've heard rumors it might be the same thing for like Sweden or Germany or the BMW in Germany. There might be, you know, that might happen. Heck, I almost feel like we're like 2 years away from a putting competition tournament. I mean, so they're, you know, he's trying. He's trying something unique. He's trying something different. I mean, I love what the PGA Tour did with the team event. I think that's awesome. I don't know what event it is, but I've heard they've added, you know, a team event for players to play in. You know, something like that I think would be really cool for the tour, but, yeah, it's tough because at the end of the day, you're not gonna knock off the PGA Tour, but you can be unique and be different. And because, I mean, it is a global tour. It's not the European Tour, so you know it has that opportunity to be enticing and engaging and you know very exciting for people to go out and watch, and you know different formats, trying things like that. It's all good and fun, and I think. You know, it's an experiment, isn't it? So you got to kind of see what works and see what kicks and see what takes off and then go from there.
Yeah, I think at minimum, at least trying these things, like you said, is the first step. And if it works, it works. Keep going for it. I like the fact that they're and I feel like there's a shift going to be going on as well in the PGA Tour with Jay Monahan taking over, and that they're going to be embracing some of these new. They've already done it once with the Zurich, like you said, the team event. And I'm sure there's going to be more changes down the way. I think that you can do so much more with, like, even with like Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Like, why not a couple times a year do some kind of skills challenge on Wednesday afternoon from the range, televise that, and kind of drum up a little bit of interest in some things that are other than, you know, just four rounds of stroke play. But so you've been out in the Euro Tour. I think this is your fifth year playing in Europe. I think we've talked at length about how on the PGA Tour, the era of guys kind of, I don't want to say socializing, but like the party era has kind of long since left the PGA Tour. The European Tour, at least like from what we can see on camera, even seems to just be more fun in general. So you mentioned kind of some of these really exotic places you guys go, or the prison weeks where you guys don't have much to do. What's the social aspect like on the European Tour?
Well, it's one of those things. I think Woody mentioned it. He hit the nail on the head. You know, you're taking flights, and then you're taking, you know, 2-3 hour bus rides, and you're doing all that together. Yeah. That's what makes it unique. You know, whereas PGA Tour guys might be, you know, flying whatever private jet back home, and you know, staying at whatever hotel. You know, it's like seems like guys might be different places. Whereas the European Tour, there's only so many places you can stay, and then everybody kind of stays at the same hotels, you take the same flights. So, you know, the lounges and the and some of those like charter flights at the end of the year, I mean, they get a little bit rowdy. And you know, but it is, I think when you're spending that much time with each other, you kind of just kind of, you know, it's like a Ryder Cup feel all the time. You know, you're always interacting and engaging with everybody and seeing them in the airports and you know, seeing them in, at the hotels. Everybody's at the same gym, basically. Everybody's at the same restaurants. So you're kind of always, you're always around each other, and you're always, you know, I guess in a weird way, you know, you're pulling for each other. You know, it seems like everybody's very nice and very supportive of what guys do, and you know, and it's impressive to see. It's really, it really surprised me, to be completely honest. I wasn't expecting it when I first came out. So for me, it was like, I mean, it was awesome. They really, really took to me, and like a lot of guys have been really good to me. So you know, I've absolutely loved it.
I think that answers the next one I was going to say is, do you ever feel a bit like an outsider just being one of the few Americans on that circuit? Because, I mean, it's mostly made up of European players, but there are, of course, players from Asia and Africa as well. But is it really kind of a thing that the borders are broken down and it's not clicky, and it's a really just kind of welcoming social environment, you'd say?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's funny because, like, yeah, you know, it's the same anywhere. You know, be out to dinner and somebody might say something about America, and I'll be like, "Hey guys, you know, like I'm American." They're like, "Well, no, right, you're here. Actually, yeah." They're like, "Oh no, you're like an adopted European." I'm like, "Well, I mean, not really, but I mean, I appreciate it, but you know." So for me, it's like, I've been lucky that I've kind of seen it from both ends of the spectrum now. And, you know, like I said, they've taken to me, and they mostly everybody's been really good to me, so. For me to be kind of, I guess they would, most guys say I'm not a typical Yank is what they call me. So for me, it's like, I guess that's a really nice compliment. So like I said, they've all been very good to me. So it's been nice.
Being outside the U.S. so much and considering all the major political shift going on in the U.S., has your I'm not going to get too political with this question, don't worry, but has your perception of the U.S. overall changed from your experience after being in so many other countries?
Yeah, I tell you what, just one thing I'll say on this topic is people don't realize how good they have it.
Yep.
Sometimes, you know, like I said, like, I add India in the schedule every year just because it's just such a humble pie that it's just, you go there, you just count your blessings. I mean, you just appreciate everything you have, you know? And so it's like, it's just going there, it's just, you come home and you're like, wow, it's like, I really can't complain about anything. So, you know, so for me, it's like, you know, you see all these things on, you know, every 4 years, it seems like everybody's a political major, and you know, they have every idea in the book on what to do. So, but for me, it's like, man, you should, you know, you just go out and just go see it, just go see what it's actually like firsthand, and then you know, and then you can actually kind of comment on it. But yeah, it's I tell you what, you see some things traveling the world, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think I forget where I was. There was some protests going on in the U.S., and I'm not saying that people don't have the right to protest and whatnot, but no. I think I was in Nigeria when it happened, and mm-hmm. It was just kind of like, wow, if the people here saw what we were protesting over, I think that it might be a little upset. So who are some of the main guys you run around with? Are you ever scheduling travel with someone, so you have somebody to travel with, or staying with somebody on the road?
No, because nobody, I'm trying, like, guys that maybe live in Florida that play, like Peter Hansen, Trevor Immelman, I mean, those guys, no, but they're out of Orlando, so I don't really, but for, like, my friend's standpoint, like, I'll, David Lipsky, who's an American, but, you know, he's Asian, and then there's, I spent a lot, like, Thomas Peters, Danny Willett, Fitzy, Lucas Beauregard. I mean, those guys are guys that, you know, I spend probably most of my time with and get along with the best, so, you know, I think, I mean, Lipsky and Lucas and Thomas all those guys are all good friends, and you know, we chat a bunch, and if we're playing the same events, you know, we try to, you know, get a practice round together or whatnot. So there's been, like, it seems to be like the PGA Tour, it seems to be a nice young influx of, you know, a good influx of young players, and you know, everybody kind of seems to get along and spends time together, and yeah, so it's fun to see.
Is there a guy out there that is probably flying under the radar as far as American fans are concerned? I don't know if Danny Willett would have been an example of that at this time last year. I mean, right. He was ranked top 15 or so in the world when he won the Masters. But is there a guy that's like, oh, these guys in the States, they don't know about this guy yet, but he is going to be an absolute stud?
Yeah, it's funny. This time last year, I would have said, Thomas Peters, which obviously he's took off. But I know I've mentioned him, you know, because I play a lot with him. But the Danish kid, Lukas Bjerregaard, is really impressive. He's very, very good. And I think once he kind of figures it out, you know, he absolutely bombs it. And he's got a nice short game. He's a good putter. But I think once he kind of figures it out and puts it all together, like he's going to be very impressive. And there's few guys like that. There's a French kid, Sebastian Gross, like nobody probably really knows. Another kid who absolutely beats the crap out of it. And, you know, same kind of style. Like he's, you know, youngish player, and he'll kind of, once he kind of figures it out, you know, he'll be a top French boy. So, then you got the guys like, you know, Wiesberger, who's done it, you know, at least, you know, he was in the final group of a major, and Jos Luton, who's been around a long time. I think those two guys are very, very good, very kind of underappreciated, and you know, very, very underrated. So I think those guys are, you know, could be next step kind of guys.
This is the $1 million question that I'm sure you've never been asked before, but how long?
I'm gonna say, have anything to do with Titleist?
No. Actually, I was gonna avoid that one actually completely.
Oh, okay.
I figured it was
fair enough.
You could probably guess it still then if by process of elimination. But how long do you plan to peg it out on the European Tour? Do you have a transition plan to maybe play the PGA Tour full time at some point? Maybe go the web.com route, or are you just gonna soak up this European Tour life for as long as you can?
Yeah, it's tough now that like. Now that I've been playing out there and I've seen it, it's a tough sell for me to maybe play the web over the European Tour. I don't know if I would ever, you know, I mean, obviously I don't know what the future holds, but it'd be tough for me to do that now. And I think with my surgery last year, I kind of missed all year. I didn't really do much, and I feel like I've just kind of taken, you know, I feel like I've been able to start over this year. So it's kind of like, I feel like this year is like almost my rookie year again. So I'm kind of just kind of taking it as it goes and letting, you know, and just kind of seeing where the cards fall. And, you know, the old saying is, you know, playing well takes care of everything. So, you know, if you play well, you know, it doesn't really, you know, it's not like there's, you know, you can base a schedule, but if you start playing better, your schedule changes. So, you know, it's kind of hard to decide or hard to determine what exactly kind of is going to, you know, what the future holds, because, you know, if you start playing well and start winning and, you know, start contending, then all of a sudden schedule changes and then, you know, it becomes different from there. So there's really no timetable for me at all. So I'm still pretty young, so I'm not really too worried about it.
Yeah, especially hearing how you describe how much you've enjoyed your travels, the places you've been and whatnot. I can't imagine it's an easy transition to go into like Boise and to go into some of the stops that are on the web tour and whatnot.
To be fair, I've never been to those places. So I guess I could check those off.
That might be more culture shock there even than in India, for all we know. So,
yeah.
You won the 2010 USAM at Chambers Bay. At what point did it become like a legal requirement for whenever you were mentioned at any point that you had to be called U.S. Amateur Champ, Peter Uihlein, or the U.S. Amateur Champ?
So I'm playing in Dubai this year, and I get paired with Richie Ramsey, former amateur champion, and Curtis Luck. And they made it their mission. I mean, completely random pairing, right? You know, random draw. And so they made it, you stand in the tee box and you know, you hear like groups in front, you know, you hear Henrik Stenson, the Open winner, you know, Sergio or whatever, you know, you hear all these guys, Tiger. I mean, Tiger was out there. You hear what, you know, 14 time major winner, whatever. And all of a sudden it's just like, yeah, you know, they have a three group of US amateur winners. And you're like, well, this is a bit weird. You know, this happened so long ago, you know, it's amateur golf. It's totally different than professional golf. So, but I mean, I'm obviously, I mean, I love, I mean, I think, you know, it's such a cool thing. And, you know, Jack, I mean, I think I remember seeing Jack Nicklaus thinks that the amateur was a major win. So, you know, he counts it as one. So I think, it's obviously something I'll have with me forever. So I'm not overly disappointed in it. That's for sure.
Were you prepared for what that the extra pressure that came with carrying that title? Or I guess first, did you feel like extra pressure was put on you after you won that event? And if so, were you how well prepared for it were you?
No, I guess I've always been in a weird situation because of who my dad is. So right. I guess to me that was always a little bit. I almost feel like the amateur thing kind of was overshadowed by, you know, just kind of the fact of who my dad is kind of thing. So for me, it's never, I guess, kind of like, you know, the accolades and whatnot are all kind of just perks, you know. I mean, I guess whatever pressure you kind of, I always feel it's always self-induced. You never really, I think if you're trying to kind of live up or, you know, recreate a situation, it's never really going to, it's tough, you know, from a mental standpoint. You know, if you're putting so much pressure, like I remember putting a lot of pressure on myself to win the amateur the next year, and I almost felt like when I didn't win, I was like a failure. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, why would I, you know, put all this amount of pressure on myself to keep performing or do well when it's in reality, it's like, hey, you know, it's like you're a pretty good golfer. Like you can just go out and carefree. You've already done it. Like, you know, just relax, have fun. And it's like, I feel like, you know, I definitely got, you know, get caught up in that. You know, like my, you know, for example, as being a pro, my rookie year, I had a good year, won, and had a couple runner ups. And all of a sudden, it's like the next year, it's like, well, I played well here last year. I didn't play well here this year. And it's like, oh, I'm immediately a worse golfer than I was the year before. And it's like, well, no, it's not necessarily the case. So I think that kind of process of just kind of growing and, you know, understanding and, you know, I guess getting better in a way mentally that, hey, you know, it's just, you know, whatever happens the year before isn't necessarily make you a better, you know, a better or a worse person or a worse player. So, I think I've been lucky with kind of my growing up, you know, with who my dad is and then having success as an amateur. And, you know, I think it's kind of helped me as a pro understand, you know, the ups and downs of the game and, the ebbs and flows of it. So,
your amateur win was at Chambers Bay. What did you think of the golf course then, and how did you think about how it played out? I don't know how much of you got to watch in 2015 of the U.S. Open. How what did you think of that course, and did you think it was worthy of hosting a major championship?
I think me and George Spieth might be the only guys that actually we might be the only guys that are partial towards this question. So I think.
Well, you played it. It was in June. What month is the U.S. Amateur Final?
It was in
final?
August.
So August. So same.
It was in August. Okay. Yeah. So it was on. It was. I won on my 21st birthday. So that was not a party. So the later in the year, it was okay because then the bent grass had a chance to grow.
Right.
I think when it's hosted in June, like, you know, you have, I guess your winter and your spring in Washington. It's not a lot of. Not a lot of sun, not a lot of good weather, is it? So the Poe is going to take over. So, you know, they at least had basically their, you know, a full summer. I remember still wearing like sweaters and rain pants in August, but, you know, at least they had a summer to where the grass and the greens can grow. Having it in June, obviously they, you know, didn't have that chance and the Poe took over. And I think that's kind of, it's a little unfortunate that's kind of the storyline. You know, you think of, you know, when somebody mentions Chambers Bay, you know, the first thing I think of was the greens and, you know, how obviously a lot of people talked about how, you know, there was a lot of complaints and a lot of, you know, controversy around the greens being the way they were. But, I guess they made some changes for it, for the U.S. Open that it was the USAM. The USGA is, I mean, give credit to them. They're pretty smart. You know, they use the amateurs as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's the same with Erin Hills. You know, we played Erin Hills the year after. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, they're using the amateur event as, you know, kind of a stepping stone for U.S. Opens. And, I mean, fair play to them. It's smart. So
you, as a result of winning that, you got paired with the defending Masters champion at the 2011 Masters, which was, of course, Phil Mickelson.
Mm-hmm.
How talkative is he during a major championship?
So I got to play with him the Wednesday you know, the day before, I got to play with them Wednesday. I played with Fowler and Couples and Phil. So just to kind of, you know, we played nine holes just to kind of get it out, like, you know, get the excitement out of the way of playing with Phil and you know, just kind of seeing what he does. And so that was fun. But then when the gun went off, it was obviously all business for him. One of the things that I found just the most fascinating thing on the planet, well, two things, I guess Phil's story. I mean, he hit a ball so far left on 13, and, you know, he walks up there, finds it, you know, hits this, I don't know, full wedge or full nine iron out back in play, then hits a, I think, six or five iron on the green, makes birdie. And I'm just like, you know, I'm just hitting in the fairway, you know, doing whatever. And he's just, I mean, he's all over the show. And he's, this is, we're on 17, he's walking off, and he's talking to Bones, and he says something, you know, he's just like, you know, Bones, it's hard to score when you can't make a putt. And I overheard it, and I'm like, I think he's hit like four fairways in 2 days. Like, but that's just the way he is. And it was just to watch that up close, watch it live, and watch just how it's just water off a duck's back when he hits a bad shot. It's just awesome. Like, it's just so cool to see. And, you know, our third member of that group was Ogilvy, who was runner up that year. So, you know, you had just basically Ogilvy, who was just stripe show. And then you had Phil just doing what Phil does. And it was awesome to see up close in person and just see some of the, you know, some of the shots he hit. And he had a couple of his patented flops. The greens were soft that year. They had a little bit of rain. So, I mean, he had some flop shots that were just incredible. So it was cool to see.
I'm trying to picture where you even can go left off 13. So he was up in the forest.
He was up in the bushes. Oh yeah. I just vividly remember him it looked like he was just like climbing a mountain to get up to where this ball was. And he gets it back in play, makes birdie, you know, hits it on the green, makes birdie. I'm just standing there. I'm like, I think I hit like 3 wood, 4 iron into the creek and make bogey. And I'm like, oh, what the hell? You know? And so it just was, it was awesome.
You shot 72 in round one, 77 yeah. round two. How much do you think back on that experience? I mean, was that you've had so much happen in your golf career? Does the Masters really stick out to you as kind of, that's your only time you've played at Augusta? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Or only time you played at the Masters, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's something like you want to get back. I mean, once you do it, like, you want to keep going back. You know, you want to. I think that's what, you know. I mean, obviously, the ultimate dream is to win it, so you can always go back. So I think that's kind of, you know, but seeing it, I would just love to see it, like, kind of playing different different every year. It's like, you know, I only saw two hole locations, whereas, you know, you watch it on TV, you see the hole location front on 13, you know, it's like, oh, I'd love to play that pin, or, you know, you see it, you know, top shelf on six or something. So it's like, man, you want to get back to go just to see these things and see them up close and see them in person to play it again. I think that's kind of the main, you know, once you do it, it's like a drug, I guess.
Are you a golf nut? It sounds like you're a golf nut.
I would say golf's about third or fourth on my spectrum of sports, to be blatantly honest with you. I mean, today was a big day for me. This is the trade deadline for the NBA. I mean, I'm a Celtics fan. So I'm a Celtics, Sox, Pats fan. So I was a little bit on edge today in seeing what they were going to do. So, but golf, I love golf. Everybody, you know, you do it for a living, you have to love it. So,
I kind of wanted to ask that because I feel like that's not necessarily the case. You get to a certain point where when it is your profession, it's a question I like to ask is, do you feel like you still love golf as much as you did as you're a kid, or do you lose a bit of the love for it when it becomes your job and your occupation?
I can honestly say I truly do love it, but, you know, there's times when I'm like, you know, I remember being in like Germany or something and I'm like dead last and I just want to get home and I'm not loving golf at all. Like, you know, so there are times that you just, you don't love it, you know, for sure. But, you know, I think, like I, you know, it's like I said earlier, I mean, it's just such a, just to sit back and just think sometimes like, hey, I do this for a living. Like, come on, there's a lot of other things that people are doing that are, you know, would love to be in my shoes. So you don't really, like I said, you don't complain very often when you realize, hey, this is your profession and this is what you get to do. And, you know, it's, you know, I would say I truly love golf. I mean, my favorite sport probably, to be completely honest with you, is baseball. I mean, I love it. Everything I'm absolutely addicted to it. And I would love, you know, if I ever have kids one day, I will definitely try to force them to play baseball. golf's a close second.
Do you watch a lot of golf when you're not playing then?
I do. I think I remember, you know, Rory saying something. He's like, I guess the cool thing is not to say I watch golf, but I watch golf. If there's like Sunday afternoon and like the Patriots are on, maybe not, or if the Sox are on, but you know, I'll flip back and forth. But I like watching because I don't really get to watch it very often. So when I'm home, I like to watch it, and I like listening to the different personalities the CBS broadcasts have. I think I see a lot of people.
Are you baiting me into this?
Yeah, a little bit. I see a lot of people, you know, vent about certain characters, but for me, I'm like, you know what? Like, I don't get to listen to them very often, so I'm like, I like listening to these guys.
Oh man, you're testing me right now. You're testing me.
Especially, you know what? I especially like the after show. You know, when a couple guys are sitting talking about players. You know, you might know a few guys I'm talking about. I don't know.
I think so. you caught me off guard with that. I think we're going to go down that avenue. But I crowdsourced a couple questions from my other No Laying Up guys. They seem to want to focus on Oklahoma State. I know you brought up Stillwater. Just how there seems to be kind of a high level of camaraderie amongst the Cowboys on tour. Were you encouraged at all to go to Oklahoma State based on who you knew you would be playing with, or was that kind of a bond that was developed once you were actually there?
A little bit of both, funny enough. I remember playing the AJGA Thunderbird, and Ricky had just talk about this now. I remember thinking, like, Ricky just committed to UCLA. And I remember, you know, and I don't know if he, like, how much I should share of it, but I remember thinking, like, I think he had some girlfriend at the time, and he was, like, wanted to kind of be close to her, and I just was like, dude, I couldn't really tell him at the time. Like, you know, I knew at this point, like, I was going to go. I mean, I grew up an Oklahoma State fan. I was going to go there. I grew up a huge Duke basketball fan, so I asked my dad, I was like, hey, what's the equivalent of Duke for golf? And he's just like, oh, it's Oklahoma State. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go there. You know, I'm like 10 years old. So I'd always kind of known I was going to go to Oklahoma State. And I remember, you know, really trying to, like, convince Ricky and be like, hey, man, you know, like, I'd love to go, you know, to OSU. Like, you know, if you want to go, like, it'd be cool. You know, it's like we can go together kind of thing. And I knew Kevin Tway was going to go there, obviously, because of his dad. And we were playing this I forget what event it is, in South Carolina. I think it was me, Tway, and Rick, and we were playing. I had committed to this point. We're playing a practice on course, intentionally pair up with Morgan Hoffman. So, you know, I remember him asking me, like, after the round, he goes, so what do I do to commit? And I'm like, what? He's like, I'm going to come. I want to come to school with you guys. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you just call coach and tell him what you're doing. So I think it was all kind of built up together. You know, we all kind of knew we wanted to play together and be together. And funny enough, we all now live in South Florida together. So, you know, we all still see each other. We're all still really close. We all spend a lot of time and hang out together. So it was definitely a bond that I guess started before college.
That's cool. Yeah, I thought that I had at least heard some remnants of that, but I didn't realize the extent of it, I guess. But they also wanted me to ask you about T. Boone Pickens, and do you have a relationship with him, or do you know anything about T. Boone Pickens?
I have something I can't really say. I remember playing the Cowboy Pro Am with him. I mean, he's got stupid money, you know, let's be honest. Yeah. I think, I forget what the check was he wrote for the athletic department, like 500 mil or something like that.
Enough to get his name on the stadium. That's all you get to know.
But the best part was, like, I'm pretty sure this was true. I think the academic department got so pissed off that he gave so much money to the athletic department, he just wrote them a check for like $300 million. So it's like, dude, you're a legend. I think when you come out with a book that says the first billion is the hardest, like, you know, you've done something right, you know.
That's relatable to a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how many people picked up that book and was just like, yeah, you know, I know what that feels like, you know, first billion. It's tough.
Few more and I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Who's like an underrated person, either tour, could be PGA, European, whatever, an underrated guy to grab a beer with?
Ooh. Probably, you know, if you want to hear good stories, probably David Howell. I mean, David Howell's got he's got tremendous stories, and he tells this one story about Augusta. He's leading after two rounds, but he basically says, he's just like, I'm hitting it like a dog. And so he asks an agent, you know, I think he asks Chubby at the time, you know, hey, can you go and find me a golf course to play? Like, cause I'm hitting it awful. You know, he's leading the Masters. Like, but David is notorious. I mean, the dude's the best putter on the planet. So, So Chubby sets him up, or I think it's Chubb, sets him up at this local course right down the road. And so he's playing and he's hitting, you know, a couple balls off each hole and, you know, just trying to figure something out for the weekend. And I guess he's standing there and, you know, he's sharing a tee box with, you know, another group. And, you know, he's teeing off one way and the other group's going the other way. And he's waiting for these guys to tee off. And they're like, no, go on ahead. So, you know, he hits a ball, hits three drives or whatever, and some guy like from the group is just like, man, you're pretty good at this. What are you, a six? you hear him tell this story, and he's just, and you just know, you're like, I mean, if that was me, I'd just be like, dude, I'm leading the Masters. Like, you know, what are you talking about? You know? But yeah, I think from a story standpoint, I mean, Howler's he's one of the best. You know, and Jamie Donaldson's a lad. Like, if you want to have a good time, like, Jamie Donaldson's he's definitely one of the more engaging characters, that's for sure.
Well, did you ever see the clip the morning after they won the Ryder Cup and he was getting interviewed on the Golf Channel?
Yeah, he's just like, yeah, I'm still drunk. I would say he's, if you're looking for a good night out, I think JD's the man.
All right. Well, I'll let you out of here on that one because that was a good story to close it with. But, Peter, thank you for your time, man. Best of luck with the rest of the season and all the crazy travels you got ahead of you. We'll definitely be following along.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks for having me, Paul.
You got it, man. Anytime. Cheers.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most.